This morning, President Trump once again commented about the removal of Confederate statues, a process that cities and states have sped up since the violent skirmishes and death of a protester in Charlottesville, Virginia, last weekend. The president tweeted, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments." White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon is also making headlines today after several interviews. He told the New York Times about statues. "Tear down more. Say the revolution is coming. I can't get enough." Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, can we start with statues? Because
sure.
As historians are rushing to explain, and as we said in our backstory segment yesterday, most of the Confederate statues were erected in the Jim Crow era or during the Civil Rights era in the 1950s as a direct challenge to civil rights. You know, blacks equate them with the statue of a Nazi being erected after Germany losing the war. Is this more of President Trump appealing to his base?
This is a part of the president's strategy to make sure that the people who are still supporting him continue to support him. And there are strong indications that they do and they will. It also shifts the focus away from talking about white supremacy, white nationalism, ideas of that kind that clearly are losers, and even the president realizes that, to talking about something else. Let's have the conversation be about statues in the park. Let's talk about people who have respect for some of the heroes of the Confederacy, who, as you have already mentioned, are viewed by many people as not so much heroes of the Confederacy as defenders of slavery.
Yeah, well, and then you have Bannon. He ran Breitbart News, which he said was a platform for what he called the alt-right. He mentions the statues in his comments to the New York Times. He said, "Give me more, tear down more statues. I can't get enough." While he told the progressive journalist Bob Kuttner in Bannon's phone call to the Liberal American Prospect, another very long interview, that the far right is a bunch of clowns, a fringe element. Take those two comments. Tear down the statues. I love it. The right, they're clowns.
He also goes on to say that he wants to see Democrats continue to emphasize race and identity. That's what he means about tear down the statues. He wants to see the Democrats make that their calling card in American politics, race and identity, because he then goes on to say, "I will crush them with economic nationalism." Mm-hmm. Now, he dismisses the people he calls ethno-nationalists, or that's maybe another way of saying white supremacists. He dismisses that group specifically as a bunch of clowns. Mm-hmm. He does not necessarily extend that to everyone who some people might call far right. After all, at Breitbart, he called that publication the publication of the alt-right, which right. Some people would conclude in far right.
Right. We'll talk more about his call to the American Prospect magazine. His friends are saying, you know, Bannon didn't know it would be turned in an interview. He had called to compliment journalist Robert Kuttner on an article about China. Others are saying Bannon is no Bambi. You know, he knows what he's doing when he calls a journalist and has this extensive conversation. So what did we learn? Talk about what he said about China, about North Korea.
We should understand it was surprising to many people that he would call Robert Kuttner, who is a well-established progressive voice of decades and decades long standing. But there was a point on which Steve Bannon was actually an admirer of Robert Kuttner's writing, and that was with respect to China and what China is up to in terms of the world economy and why the United States needs to view China in a particular way. Bannon called him up to say, "You're nailing it. Keep it up." Now, he, as you say, is no innocent when it comes to talking to journalists. He talks to journalists a lot. I think a lot of people would be shocked at how much Steve Bannon talks to journalists. So he knew perfectly well that he was going to be asked questions off the subject of China, and he did wander quite far off the subject of China himself in talking about some of these subjects that we have brought up. But Robert Kuttner had pleased him with respect to some of the things that Steve Bannon wants to do in opposing China.
But what did we learn? I mean, he says, you know, we're going to run the tables on these guys, meaning China. He said of North Korea, that's just a sideshow. Really? You know, feels pretty serious. He talked about how he was working to remove people from position in the government, people that he wanted replaced with hawks. He talked about how they're fighting every day in the administration.
When he talks about hawks, he's talking about trade. He's talking about economics. Mm-hmm. He's not talking about military hawks necessarily, because in Steve Bannon's world, you want to de-emphasize military opposition or a military conflict and emphasize the sense in which we are in competition for China. He said, one of these two countries is going to be the world hegemon, in other words, the dominant world economic power in 20, 25 years. And he wants it to be the United States, but he fears that on our current trade patterns path, it will be China.
Yeah. Well, one wonders how the acting assistant secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs at the State Department feels, because he said he's ousting her and getting hawks in there. But also, just briefly, the fighting that he talked about, as if everybody's kind of squared off in their corner in the White House battling.
Yes, the way he portrays life, not just in the White House, but in the administration as a whole and across the federal government as a whole, is a struggle where Steve Bannon is trying to replace people, as he very frankly said, with people who agree with him about this economic war, de-emphasizing some of the more military conflict, de-emphasizing some of the more political conflict, and putting the emphasis where Steve Bannon, the former hedge fund manager and Goldman Sachs executive, thinks it ought to be, which is on competition with China in Asian markets.
Okay. We'll post the interviews at hearnow.org. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, at the center of last weekend's violence in Charlottesville, that statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. White supremacists and hate groups were in the city to protest plans to remove that statue. Counter-protesters were there to oppose them. Another showdown in another southern city over what to do with Confederate symbols of the Civil War. But the South is not alone when it comes to dealing with uncomfortable chapters in the nation's history. At a post office in Durham, New Hampshire, a 1950s-era mural has sparked debate about racial stereotypes. Jason Moon from New Hampshire Public Radio has the story.
Let them know we're coming, so...
Town Administrator Todd Selig is showing me around the post office in Durham, New Hampshire. Inside, the usual boxes, stamps, greeting cards. There's a long counter where postal workers help customers. But Selig isn't here to show me how the mail works. We're here to see a mural that runs along the top half of the walls inside the post office.
I really can't miss it.
It almost looks like there are posters on the wall, but it's actually painted on the wall.
16 of these painted-on posters make up the mural. Each one depicts a different chapter of Durham's history. And they all come with stirring titles. Relentless Progress shows a train steaming through town. Steadfast Faith shows the Durham Community Church standing proudly. For the most part, the images are idyllic renderings of Durham's beginnings, painted by a local artist.
It was dedicated in 1959 by the Women's Club of Durham with all the best intentions. They didn't set out to create a racist, discriminatory mural set.
But to some, that's exactly what this is. At issue is one image in the mural that shows a Native American. He's crouched behind a bush, eyeing a colonial cabin. He's carrying a bow and arrows, and in one hand is a flaming torch. The image is titled Cruel Adversity. The painting is meant to represent the threat of Native American attacks on the town, including one in particular, the so-called Oyster River Massacre of 1694. During the raid, about 100 colonists, men, women, and children, were either killed or captured.
It portrays the colonists as victims.
Kathleen Blake is a member of the New Hampshire Commission on Native American Affairs. She says the Cruel Adversity mural is derogatory and leaves out the many acts of aggression committed by European settlers.
I mean, it could be the other way around. The Cruel Adversity could be the settlers in the garrison house rather than the Native people who already lived here.
Blake and the Commission on Native American Affairs want this panel of the mural removed or covered. But Postal Service spokesperson Steve Daugherty says that isn't an option.
The Postal Service policy is, you know, this is something that was a piece of artwork that was given to us as a gift back in the late 50s. And as now the curator of that art, our job is to protect it and preserve it for future generations.
The Postal Service has offered to install interpretive text near the mural to provide some of the missing historical context. The job of drafting that text fell to Jennifer Lynch, Postal Service historian. After some research at the Library of Congress and consultation with local experts, Lynch submitted a one-page summary of historical context that could accompany the mural.
I tried to show that it was complicated, and there wasn't one side. One side is always the victim, you know, and one side always the aggressor. It wasn't that way at all. It was a complicated situation, a lot of conflict.
The text describes how an early period of peace descended into a cycle of attacks and reprisals, including the enslavement of hundreds of local Native Americans about 20 years before the Oyster River Massacre. Back in present-day Durham, debate about the mural has made its way into town council meetings. At a meeting last month, Councillor Feroz Kotrak said the image was nothing residents today should be ashamed of.
We should be taking pride in the Western civilization. We should be taking pride in our local history. And I don't think white males have anything to apologize for.
For now, the issue is on hold. The Native American Commission hasn't decided if they're willing to settle for interpretive text. The Postal Service wants the commission's input before they would install any text. The Women's Club of Durham, which originally commissioned the mural, is no longer around. But a pamphlet they published in the 1980s suggests they wouldn't mind all the attention the mural's been getting. The pamphlet asks, quote, "What better place than the post office to ensure its display for the entire community and visitors?" For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon.
What's the future of communication? It's a big question, but one that's on the mind of tech companies as they develop apps to better serve customers around the world. And in places like India, companies are finding that people often rely less on typing and texting, giving their thumbs a break on their smartphones, and instead they use apps that are powered by their voice. Eric Bellman has been writing about this. He's Deputy South Asia Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us now from Delhi, India, via Skype. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Meghna.
Well, so first of all, when we talk about voice apps or voice-controlled apps, I mean, is it similar to when people pick up their iPhone and use Siri to dictate a text message to someone?
It is a lot like that. In fact, it's apps first developed for the developed world that have become so good at listening to voices and interpreting what people are saying that even people in other countries can use them now. But it's not so much Siri. Not many people can afford Apples here. It would be more going to the Google search and pushing on the mic. And that seems to be sort of the entrance to the internet for millions of new people in India and around the world now that they have affordable connectivity.
Interesting. And so when did you first start noticing this trend towards people using their voice to power or use apps?
There's little bits and pieces over the years, but it wasn't until they had access to affordable data that I really saw the big change. Right now, data plans have come down to less than $5 a month for unlimited 4G, sort of unprecedented price points here. And all of a sudden, that opens the internet up to a whole new group of people. And that group of people, when I looked around India, I was seeing all of a sudden all these people sort of whispering to their phones and all these people sort of staring at their screens, the kind of folks that wouldn't be spending much time staring at their screens before. They had simple Nokia-like phones before, and now they're doing much more sophisticated stuff in there, and it's because they have 4G access. And they found out very quickly that voice was the game changer for them because they either didn't understand English, either can't even read or write their own language, or at the very least aren't comfortable with keyboards. Mm. So for the first time, when you've got 4G access, you can do all these things. And it's mostly just search with voice, look at videos. And so that means the big winner so far in terms of global names has been Google and YouTube.
Right. So you mentioned something there which I wanted to ask you more about, the question of a much lower price point. By the way, $5 a month for unlimited 4G. I'm sure everyone in the United States who just heard that thought, get me to that price point. Is literacy a big part of this, or sort of lower literacy rates at people who can afford that price point? Because you were saying that they use voice with their phones, and really video is a big winner here.
Right. Well, this you have to understand. They saw it happening around them. There is the creamy layer of India that can afford these things, that's very comfortable with English, that is very comfortable with typing, that's very tech savvy. But there's been a large chunk of the country that has felt locked out. And now, because of these price points, triggered, interestingly, by a sort of a price war triggered by India's richest man, Mukesh Ambani, bringing these price points down to ridiculously low levels. So everybody, even somebody that, you know, makes $5 a day, can say, let me try out this internet thing. Once they got onto it, they started using it in very different ways than you and I do.
Do analysts think that these ultra low price points are sustainable?
That's a good question. I think the play is, like a lot of plays, for Mukesh Ambani anyhow, is that if you bring enough new people online and find other things to sell them, advertising, little services, sort of add-ons to your phone, that yes, it is sustainable. That's the idea. But yes, most analysts say it's going to be hard to sustain this for a long time. I will say also, when you say 4G, it's not quite 4G. I think it's not quite the experience a lot of people would like, and it's not everywhere. A lot of neighborhoods just don't have the 4G, even if you theoretically could have the access to it. So it remains to be seen. But if this new price point sticks, we really do have a whole new group of people that are getting online like never before.
It does make you wonder. I mean, everything about India is vast. So we are talking about millions and millions of people suddenly being given access to smartphone technology. It's got to make you wonder how that might change Indian society.
Yes, hundreds of millions of people theoretically can have access now. And I think it will change. It's going to change the conversation. The government has noticed power of the internet, and when there's certain regions for different communal reasons, et cetera, there's rioting. They often turn off the internet because bad rumors are being spread or bad information is being spread. So you could see it changing a lot of things. It makes the job search very easy for people, much easier for people. It makes education a lot easier for people. It makes safety easier. Everything that we use it for in our life, these folks, these new over 500 million people in India that will be getting online in the next 5 years or so, they're going to have similar versions. It'll just be different from the way you and I do it.
Now, before I let you go, yeah, Eric, I just want to ask you, it seems like a lot of the most popular apps that folks are using in India, especially voice-powered apps, seem to be virtually unknown in the United States. The ones I've never heard of, UC Browser, MX Player, ShareIt, what are they?
It's really interesting. These are apps developed in Asia. A lot of these, their secret is they use less data, and they also allow you to do things offline. So they allow you to download videos, they allow you to surf the internet by using less data. So it's about people with low-powered phones and less money being able to do things. And companies here, UC Browser, 40% of the phones here use UC Browser. In the U.S., it's less than 1%. ShareIt and MX Player are examples of one of the first stops a new person with a smartphone will go to. It's unheard of in the West. So these are examples of apps that could become the new sort of tech titans of the next generation of tech leaders.
Well, Eric Bellman is Deputy South Asia Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. He's speaking to us about the popularity of voice apps in India. Eric, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
So by now, you know there's a total solar eclipse on Monday, but have you told your dog? It's said that birds go silent, bees head to the hive, but what more do we know about creatures during a total eclipse? Vicky Crow covers all things animal for us. And Vicky, this reminds me of the exchange from Ghostbusters. 40 years of darkness, human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. But what do we know?
Not so much as it turns out, Robin. So there have been accounts, some observations, most of them not methodical, dating back as far as the 1500s. Mm-hmm. And there are some common threads to them. So you might expect that some animals would behave as though it's nighttime during an eclipse. And we have, over the centuries, a bunch of those anecdotes. Crickets suddenly chirping, horses heading back to the barn, owls emerging. But is that verifiable science? I asked Elise Ricard. She's with the California Academy of Sciences, and she's been leading an eclipse initiative there. Here's what she had to say about the nature of those observations.
The most common one you might hear is that birds stop singing, and that's something that I actually got to witness for myself back in 2012 in Australia. I was on a beach, middle of the morning. The rainforest behind me goes quiet, which is an eerie, eerie thing. So people who have been seeing eclipses for a while, who've seen them before, have plenty of stories about how animals react. There's not a lot of research.
So one academic journal in the 1930s said the problem was that most of the observations were made by astronomers who were actually too busy and distracted watching the eclipse.
So everyone looks up instead of at the animal life.
Exactly. So bird experts like Kevin McGowan, he's at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, do suspect and think that it would make sense in a total eclipse. Birds might stop what they're doing, sit still, and take cover, though he's seen birds shrug off partial eclipses. In general, there are some pretty funny, intriguing notes from the field about lots of animals. Hippos in the Zambezi River looking nervous to observers in 2001, llamas gathering near an eclipse observer in Bolivia in 94, and ducks that appeared sad in Galveston.
It's a duck. All right. Okay.
During the solar eclipse of 1878. There are nocturnal fish seen coming out-of-cover daytime fish going in the Galapagos in 94. For this upcoming eclipse, one oceanographer is equipped to see if zooplankton will rise. And it doesn't have to be about the light itself triggering the change. Things like the drop in temperature from an eclipse can affect animals.
Yeah, the sun is gone. It suddenly can get windy and cold.
That's right. Yeah. So a study from 91 indicates that some cicadas in Arizona stopped singing temporarily during a partial eclipse. But studying animals during eclipses is tough.
Okay, so what do we do? How do we do that?
There's an app for that, Robin. This is where Elise Ricard comes back in. The California Academy of Sciences already has a free mobile app called iNature. They're up to about 5.5 million uploads. That's of just regular nature observations taken by people of the last couple of years. But for Monday's eclipse day, they'll have a special launch of a citizen science initiative called Life Responds. With that, you can upload pictures, make brief notes, tag your location. Mm. They're hoping people will take pictures around the peak before and after. You don't have to be in the path of totality. And they're happily taking observations of wild animals, zoo animals, companion animals. We know that millions of people will be watching the eclipse. So Elise Ricard says there's just no telling how many observations they may get on that day, even if you're saying or showing that that dog you were talking about isn't acting strangely at all. That's still data. There may be some great surprises. And at the least, this will provide some baseline information and may help identify patterns. And it'll be made available to everybody who wants it.
Fabulous. We will link you to all this information. I just want to say you want to be careful of the people around you who want totality, that you're not there, you know, with your cell phone and flash and everything observing your dog. But if you are sure that you're not ruining somebody else's eclipse watching, what a great chance to see how animals react and add some data to scientific understanding. Vicky Krogh, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Baseballs are flying out of major league ballparks at a record pace this summer. We talked about this earlier in the season, but let's get an update on what's happening. Hitters from the American and National Leagues have already blasted more than 4,000 home runs, and if they keep that pace up, they'll break the record set back in 2000. That year, there were 5,693 home runs. So what's behind this season's power surge? Mike Pesca is Here Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi there, Mike.
Hello.
So what is the explanation for this surge?
Well, the balls themselves, I wouldn't say they're juiced, but some pitchers are complaining that the seams on them are really low. You can't get a good grip. Okay, I'll put that aside and say maybe that's something. But here's what's really going on. There are advanced statistics and advanced ways to analyze a player's swing. And so now they're able to calculate the swing velocity. And just simple physics, a ball will leave the park when the player swings harder. Now, if you adjust your swing, so not only are you swinging harder, but you're swinging with an uppercut, balls will leave the park in greater number. And that seems to have taken hold throughout baseball. There's been a slight change in philosophy, a change in coaching at the minor league levels. Players are encouraged to uppercut. Strikeouts are not as anathema as they once were. And so we're getting this confluence of, you know, big, huge players swinging fast, swinging the right way, not worrying about strikeouts. Boom, the balls are leaving the park.
Okay, so it's not the pitcher's fault then. I mean, is there anything that they can do to compensate?
Yeah, I guess they could walk guys. No, probably not. I mean, this is because pitchers aren't, if you look at the ERAs and the pitching statistics, they're not terrible. You know, they're not as bad as they were during that PED era when the explanation for home runs, the plausible explanation, was just that batters had bulked up and were sort of superhuman monsters.
The asterisk era, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, so one player who's getting a lot of attention for his home runs is Giancarlo Stanton of Miami. He's having a really great season. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, he just hit, not yesterday, but he just hit 6 home runs in a row, and he has 44, and he's on a pace to hit 60. Now, if he does, that'll tie Babe Ruth, but of course, in the record books, there are 5 other names ahead of him, Roger Maris with 61, and then that trio of PED-inflected players from the late 90s, early 2000s, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds, and you know, all of them, McGwire admitted to doing home runs, McGwire admitted to doing steroids or performance enhancing. Answers. You know, Bonds did too. People will say, no, he never admitted to knowingly taking it. Yes, he admitted to applying a substance called the cream on himself. He said he didn't know what was in the cream, but it was a performance enhancer. So he has admitted to performance enhancing drugs. And, you know, tests later revealed that Sosa also cheated by taking PED. So, you know, Stanton could be the first guy with 60 home runs since Ruth and Maris.
Wow. Well, that's Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.
70 years ago this week, Hindu-majority India gained its independence from Britain. The day before, Pakistan, the Muslim-majority state created by the retreating British, declared its independence. But independence for both came at a terrible price. Some 15 million people fled to either side during partition, and by some estimates, over 1 million people were killed in the violence that erupted. Want to learn more? Well, we wanted to look at partition through the prism of books, the literature that came from the divide. NPR's Asia editor, Nishant Tahiya, who's of Indian descent, has a list. Nishant, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
Because this is fascinating and an incredibly powerful time. Just before we get to the books, remind us this moment in time, what it means to people in Pakistan and India.
It is sort of the defining moment of modern South Asia. You know, the division of India into two countries, but Pakistan, let's not forget, when it was divided, was originally East and West Pakistan. East Pakistan later on became the country of Bangladesh. And between them lay this huge state of India. And whenever you read a book, for example, say out of Europe, or a movie, and it says it has a deep, dark secret at its heart, you know that the deep, dark secret goes somehow, it goes all the way back to World War II.
Right.
Partition and independence for these countries is very much that kind of seminal moment.
It's their World War II. Tragic, you remind us, the photographer Margaret Burke White, who shot some of the defining moments of the Holocaust in World War II, said what about India?
She had arrived, so World War II ended in 45 and partition happened in 47. So right after the end of World War II, she arrived in India. You saw these huge migrations of Hindus and Sikhs moving towards India and Muslims towards Pakistan. And she chronicled this and she said that some of the savageries she saw compared with some of the things she had seen,
they were as bad as in the Holocaust.
As in the Holocaust.
Yeah. So how is this captured through literature? We'll have the list of all your books at hereandnow.org, but start with one.
I chose 5 books, 4 of them are fiction, 1 nonfiction. Let's start with the nonfiction one. It's a great primer on independence. It's called Midnight's Furies. It's by the journalist Nisad Hachari. And it's a really easy, accessible book. It's only just over 250 pages long. And it's got these great character sketches, which I thought were astounding, especially of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. But most importantly, of the man who in Pakistan is regarded as the father of the nation, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And the book really portrays the obstinacy of Jinnah, but also how poisonous the relationship between Nehru and Jinnah was, which then led the British to believe that these two people really, they just can't live with each other. And so the best thing to do for South Asia is to actually divide
draw
them.
Draw a line.
Yeah. Draw a line.
Kind of incredible. So that's a great primer with, it sounds like, a lot of humanity in it, a lot of, you know, as you said, character sketches. The fiction books.
The first one I want to mention is probably the one that's the most famous, and that's Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie. Mm. You know, Salman Rushdie, for anybody who's read him, knows he's a magical realist. It's got this fabulous hallucinatory style.
And a magical idea. It's about the first, 1,000 children born post-partition.
That's right. The 1,001 children born in India. And because he's Salman Rushdie, he gives each one of them a magical power. Through these characters, you learn both the history of India post-partition, but also how partition came to be and the events that led up to it. And it's just a great yarn and one of the great novels of the last century, and it's must reading for everybody.
Okay, Midnight's Children. Must reading. Yeah, so that there, some ears went up. Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie. Next, another piece of fiction from someone who's well-known in India, a journalist who wrote a column and would skewer Delhi's elite. The column was called Malice Towards One and All. What's the book?
The book is called Train to Pakistan. And the symbolism of trains in the story of partition is very important. You have these huge populations migrating. By some estimates, 15 million Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims migrated, making it the largest migration in human history. Hmm. And many of them crossed on foot in these large caravans, but many of them also crossed on trains. And what would happen was that mobs would attack these trains, or militias would attack these trains. And so the trains would arrive in India or in Pakistan with everybody on them butchered and murdered.
You know, that was real.
That happened. And so he uses that as basically the set piece for his book, which is, you know, a fictional village. It's right on the border between India and Pakistan. Sikhs and Muslims have lived there in peace for centuries. But then they see one of these trains pass through their village and it breaks them and it just completely shatters the village and shatters the peace out there.
Oh, man. I mean, we're reminded this was such a traumatic event.
For that part of the world, incredibly.
Okay. You have two books now for us. Which are these?
They're both by Pakistani writers. The first one is by what many people consider to be South Asia's Chekhov. He was a writer of short stories, immensely talented, gifted, powerful short story writer. His name is Sadat Hasan Manto. He grew up in India. You know, he spent most of his life in India. He wrote screenplays for what was then, you know, the very nascent Bollywood. But then he eventually left and he spent the last few years of his life in Pakistan. He was penniless. He died of alcoholism at the age of 42. He was very young. So you never know what he could have actually gone on to achieve. But his stories capture the absurdity of partition, the cruelty of partition, the madness of partition. And many of them revolve around the events of partition.
So is it true, for instance, he writes about how absurd it got in many ways, that the books were divided in the libraries? Is that true?
Everything was divided, including down to the last paper clip between the governments of India and Pakistan. And his most famous story, Toba Tek Singh, it's set essentially in a mental asylum. Mm-hmm. And the bureaucrats between India and Pakistan decide that, well, since we've exchanged everything, that the Hindus in the asylum should go to India and the Muslims in the asylum should go to Pakistan. So why don't we, you know, separate these two? And these people don't know where they are, don't know who they are anyway. And so, you know, the story is really about the absurdity and the madness of partition.
It sounds like a South Asian One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Except that it's only about 5 pages long.
Okay. Well, again, we'll have the list at herenow.org, but I know there's one last one that you want to talk about.
This is the one I read most recently and perhaps one of my favorite of all of these books. It's called Basti, which literally means a settlement or a place to stay. It's by the Pakistani writer Intisar Hussain. And it's a novel that moves very much, it moves back and forth in time. It's set before partition, during partition, and then during the events of 1971 when India and Pakistan fought a war that created the state of Bangladesh. The main character, Zakir, he grows up in India, becomes a university lecturer there. Then his family flees to Pakistan at the time of partition. But as a young man in India, he falls for his cousin. And really, it's a love story, or a love story that never quite happens, because she stays in India and his family moves to Pakistan and they can just never connect after that. And even though she fades away from his memories over the years, the fact that the author chooses to leave them both unmarried, I think, is very poignant.
Yeah. Well, Romeo and Juliet writ large, but also the two countries were separated, you know, two countries and two people separated. Nishant Tahiya, just very briefly, as you read these books, some of them, you know, Salman Rushdie goes back to 1980, some new.
Many of these were written in the 50s,
right
after partition.
Yeah, so, I mean, they go back further. And how do you read them now? You're young, too. I mean, is this reflecting on something your grandparents might have told you about? Or
I heard stories of partition growing up. But reading them today in 2017, or rereading some of these today in 2017, the thing that struck me was how much it is like the world we're living in today with the global refugee crisis. You see all these stories of people leaving everything they knew, uprooting themselves, marching in many cases thousands of miles away to find new homes and new lives. There are lives they've left behind, there are people they've left behind, and places and memories that they'll probably never see again. When you talk to partition survivors, the longing for what they've lost is so immense and powerful.
Still,
even today, 70 years later, the friends that they had that they've lost. These are some of these stories are really, really hard to read. They're incredibly powerful. Some of them are incredibly violent, incredibly graphic in how they depict that violence. But they ring true.
Yeah. NPR Asia editor Nishant Dahiya. Again, his list is at herenow.org. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Incredible piece of history. Quick note now, later today on All Things Considered, legal battles over racial and partisan gerrymandering are intensifying, and mathematicians think they can help. Specialists in geometry are training their colleagues to become expert witnesses in redistricting cases. That's later today, ATC.
Have you ever driven down a city street and seen someone zoom past you on a dirt bike, popping wheelies as they weave through traffic? Well, how about 10, 50, or 200 of them? In cities such as Atlanta, Baltimore, and Cleveland, urban dirt biking has caused rifts between young people, drivers, and the police, with large groups of riders congregating for daredevil rideouts on busy roads. In New Haven, Connecticut, there is plenty of that. But there's also a group of riders on pedal bikes who say that for them, wheelieing is more than just a nuisance or a cool trick. Here and Now's Phoebe Petrovic talked with one of the young people who uses wheelieing as a community organizing tool.
When Carl Lewis G. Jr., he goes by CJ, zooms into the parking lot, he revs the motor on his moped, shifts his body back, and lifts the front wheel into the air. It's a rearing steed of glinting blue metal, popping a wheelie.
Whatever I can lift up, I lift it.
But CJ says he's just learning how to wheelie on a moped. He mostly sticks to pedal bikes. Today, his has a flat, so he brought this. CJ says he popped his first wheelie at 8 or 9. He's 21 now, and he's known around town for fixing bikes and wheelieing.
When I hop on that wheelie, it feels like I'm just, like, chilling, like, at a beach with the sun, with, like, the little tents, drinking iced tea and stuff.
On a pedal bike, CJ can whip wheelies as quick as match strikes or float in slow-mo down the block. And often, he zips through traffic-choked roads without fear. Drivers hate it.
When you take 10 kids and put them in a pack and have them ride a bike, it scares everybody.
Lieutenant Jason Renkowitz heads the New Haven Police Department's bicycle unit. He says he's seen rideouts with as many as 50 pedal bikes.
Young guys organizing 50 or more bicycles to go for a ride is going to be pretty chaotic. Especially if they're going to be swerving in between cars, riding the wrong way on one ways.
That reckless pack riding resembles another type of riding that is wildly popular and sort of illegal, called bike life. Bike lifers ride dirt bikes and ATVs, motorized vehicles which are illegal to ride on city streets. Lieutenant Renkowitz called New Haven a staging ground for New England bike life. His take on it?
Their goal is not to go out and have a joyful ride, it's to terrorize the community.
Lieutenant Renkowitz notes the distinction between bike life and the pedal bike riding CJ does. But he also warns that some kids graduate from pedal bikes to dirt bikes, and then some to bike life. Renkowitz says police are out to prevent that with a strategy that involves talking to pedal bike riders about riding responsibly. And judging by CJ, that pitch only sort of works.
Sometimes, I'm not gonna lie, yeah, we do get close to the cars and, like, we swerve. But now we don't do it to be funny, like, or, like, we mean it. We're just doing it because, like, we in that zone. Like, you can't, I don't know, there's no way you can stop us.
Sometimes the law has to step in. CJ's gotten tickets for reckless riding, endangering minors, breach of peace. But those are minor infractions, CJ tells the cops, compared to the alternatives. Wheelieing, he says, is a way to relieve stress and stay out of trouble.
I was like, you'd rather sit here and wheelie or go and get a gun or go on the corner and sell drugs. You tell me. I just get happy when I see little kids doing good stuff like wheelieing, use any time, like creative, you know. Because they'd be like, oh, CJ, I want to get better. I want to be like you one day. I'd be like, all right, come on, get your pass, get everything. We're going into, like, an empty space, and we just wheelie.
Not everyone is thrilled about that type of role model. Lee Cruz is a longtime resident of Fairhaven, the neighborhood he shares with CJ. He has a 6-year-old son.
He just learned how to ride a bike, and so he's asking me, you know, Papa, do you know how to pop a wheelie? And I say, no, you know, I don't do that because it's not safe, particularly on the street. But you know, you see all these kids laughing and having fun and their friends praising them. So it kind of sends the message, oh, like, this is a cool thing to do.
Together, neighborhood residents and police are working to forge compromises with CJ and his friends so they can tolerate and maybe even appreciate each other.
On three, let's go. One, two, three, let's go.
An opportunity came during New Haven's Bike Month in May. In CJ's neighborhood, they held a wheelie competition. And among the judges, the mayor and a police officer CJ had seen around town. His riding impressed Sergeant Derek Warner.
I think CJ made it all the way down around the cone and back without losing his wheelie. I thought he was going to at least fall, you know, the wheel was going to come down one time, but it didn't.
And he and CJ both say that the competition was a chance to get to know each other better.
So every time he see me, he said, what up? And the mayor was there. So I took a picture with Tony Harper and stuff. She was like, wow, kid, she like, you got talent. And she was with her big bodyguard. Like, he was like, kid, you got skills. He was like, never give up your dream. And that's another thing. My friend Jericho, he died in a drive-by shooting, and he said, never give up on your dream. He said, God gives people gifts, and you should be able to use them. So God gave me a gift fixing bikes and wheeling, you know.
CJ says wheeling is his dream, and he's not going to give up on it. He'll keep on fixing bikes, teaching little kids, and getting better at wheeling a moped.
Nah, I'm going to try to wheelie it, though. Let's see.
For Here and Now, I'm Phoebe Petrovic.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.